you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD, Tubi, and Amazon Prime, and my second feature is written on the page.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in pre-production on Best Friends Forever, my next feature. I'm a producer's rep, and I used to work at Sundance.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 174 from September 2018 with writer and director Paulina Lagudi, who talks about making her first feature film, Mail Order Monster, having co-produced a feature beforehand. I thought Paulina was a good match for Zoe because they both talk about making their first feature and they both had produced a feature before writing and directing their own solo features. So I thought that was a good matchup. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page. This is the way the show continues to exist, to thrive, to live. You can check us out at patreon.com/MMIH podcast. We don't have anything really special going on right now for the patrons, but we are working on stuff. Liz says no, but I say in the background, it's churning, it's happening. But thank you all to all the patrons who support the show. We really appreciate it. It is really what is allowing us to pay for Jeff to keep the show moving. And make sure to give us a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts. That is another big way to help the show. But without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Paulina Lagudi.
Well, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, you guys.
This is exciting to talk to somebody who's recently finished their first feature film. And we watched the trailer, and one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because it's a genre film. It's cool that it's like kind of kids mixed with, what would you say, science fiction fantasy?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely got like those sci-fi, fantasy, adventure, family elements. I loved those elements about, you know, very traditional family films from like the 80s and the 90s. Oh, and I kind of really wanted to do an ode to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun, but it definitely came with some challenges for sure.
Before we get into your 1 minute bio, I do have one quick question for you.
Yeah.
And you might not have seen my movie, but I made a movie called The Spirit Machine, and it also has a girl. She's in my movie. She's roughly like 16 years old, and she lost her mom. And I was wondering,
oh wow,
where did we come up with this idea of a girl losing her mom? Where were we influenced? Because I don't totally know.
For me, it's a lot of like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, a lot of this came from my own life. I mean, I haven't lost my mom as in like a death lost my mom, but a lot of this came from my own life in a lot of ways. And I don't know. I think sometimes when you're working in family movies, you're working in like the kids' world, it's sometimes nice to really like just get to the bare bones of things, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? And really kind of like break it down. Whereas like, it's a little bit more difficult to tell a very streamlined family movie where it's like this girl who has a strained relationship with her mother, but she's still kind of in the picture, but they only text every day. You know what I mean?
Right. Let's give her a huge tragedy up front that she has to overcome.
Yeah.
I think it's like, there's something about a loss of a parent, loss of a loved one, that's just good foundation for a story, no matter what. I mean, Bambi starts off with her mom being killed.
Yeah. I mean, Lion King, so many of them they do that. Yeah.
It's classic. All right. So let's jump into a 1 minute bio. Try to distill your life up until this point in 1 minute, if you can.
Oh boy. 1 minute bio. Here we go. So I'm originally from Sydney, Australia. My family and I moved to Las Vegas in the year 2000. And so I grew up there for a very, very long time. I went to Chapman University in Southern California, and I was a dancer growing up. I was a competitive dancer. And right before college, I had a terrible foot injury that kind of got me into the world of theater and film and whatnot, and went to Chapman. And that was awesome. After Chapman, I met my fiance, who's a cinematographer. And since then, we've been making things together. I created my production company, Jax Productions. And I've been very fortunate to make, you know, short films, or branded content, commercials, and then this feature film, Mail Order Monster, and I write as well. So I've been able to write scripts, and most recently got a feature film script job off of Mail Order Monster, which was pretty cool.
Awesome.
So that's a minute, I think, of
nice. Yeah, that was great. I mean, that's because that opens up so many new questions, right, Ulrich?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to jump right into like getting the job off of Mail Order Monster, because I feel like that's the ultimate goal for a lot of filmmakers, is to make a movie and then get an actual professional job from it.
Yes.
So yeah, can you talk about how that all played out?
Absolutely. It was very unexpected. So essentially, when I made my film, I sent out the screener when it was completed to a bunch of different sales reps and companies that I had already had conversations with before. And this one company was interested in distributing the film and taking it on for foreign sales. And they weren't who I went with in that regard. And then because I, you know, had a different relationship with this other company and it just was a better deal. But then they ended up calling me like a week later and they were like, listen, we know it didn't work out with Mail Order Monster, but we have this story. It's a true story. It's also a family film. We loved the Mail Order Monster like script and story so much. We've been having these writers do treatments and we're not really finding what we want. Would you mind giving a stab at it? And I was like, sure. They said, okay, you know, this is essentially the scope of what is, and then just like send us a treatment in a couple of days. And so I was like, cool. Yeah. And then they, you know, were telling me about the budget they were working with. And I was like, oh my God, this is a bigger budget than I would even know what to do with. So I was like, yeah, I can do it. So I'm like, oh my God, I don't even know how to write a true story. Nice. Blah, blah, blah. But then I threw it together and I ended up getting the job, and it's a co-production between Brazil and America and Canada, I think. So it's like a Brazilian based story. So I'm like, I never would have thought I'd be writing a family film about an old man and a penguin and a true story in Brazil. I'm like, this is unreal. But yeah, they ended up getting the job, and then we just signed a contract a couple months ago, and I just sent in the first draft last month.
Wow, that's
so it happened
awesome.
pretty quickly. Yeah, it was super awesome. But it was very unexpected. And then speaking to your point about like getting jobs off of your movie, it's very it's difficult, especially when that gap between when you complete it and when it comes out, like no one's seen it. You know what I mean? So it's hard to get jobs off of that. So you kind of feel like after you do a movie, you're like, cool, I did a movie. No one cares.
until
it comes to the time where it's like, okay, now I get to promote it, and now I get to like, you know, now I get to start sending it out and people get to see it. But I was very, very lucky in this scenario. I mean, it was a total, I don't even know. It was just like the universe threw me a bone, I guess.
But you know, even after you've like, after the movie's out in the world, it's not like immediately as day one, as soon as it's out, all these opportunities start coming. It could be like a year later as someone had seen it and then remembers you when they have this project that comes up. That's what's weird about, I feel like, the waiting for something to happen with your film, is that you don't know when that is gonna occur. So there was actually a topic we didn't get to in one of our solo episodes a few weeks back, where I wanted to talk about kind of that feeling of, yeah, you finish your movie and it's kind of set up for the release, and you know, you've already done one premiere at a film market and it's about to come out in November, so maybe you don't have the totally feel this yet. But I always felt like when a movie comes out, you think that it's going to be this kind of like big firework explosion, and that's going to be like kind of the peak of the experience of it. But it actually always, to me, felt a little anticlimactic. Like the filmmaking process never really peaks anywhere. There's kind of like peaks and valleys throughout the process, rather than it building up to this one big crescendo.
Absolutely. No, you're 100% correct there. I think that's also why it's like, and I kind of learned this I learned this lesson pretty quickly after we finished the movie, because we finished it very quickly. I mean, I started writing the script November 2016. We shot the movie July 2017. The movie was completed December 2017. It premiered February 2018 in Berlin. So it was like an extremely, extremely fast process. And you're absolutely right. Like, I pretty much had to learn the lesson of like, you know, you really can't do it for that validation. You know what I mean? You really can't do it for that.
Right.
Like, everyone loves me, kiss my feet, I made a movie,
right?
Because you'll just really end up disappointed. You just have to, you know, no matter what, like go back to square one. Like after we finished our movie, my fiance and I, we just were making no budget, low budget shorts and specs. And then a friend of mine, you know, hired me to, we collaborated on a commercial for her food product as well. But we were just like, you know, just keep creating stuff, you know, with what we have. We own a camera. It's like, yes, we just did a feature, but we have to keep always going back to the drawing board and keep grinding and grinding, you know?
Right. And I guess that's the lesson. It's not like your life changes overnight. You know, it changes. And if you're like trying to steer your boat 90 degrees, the length of the feature film, kind of like every little piece of it that kind of changes your trajectory only changes it by like a degree at a time. So, you know, one day you'll wake up and you'll realize you're facing 90 degrees, but it's not like an abrupt change. It just happens slowly over time.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's 100% correct.
So was, making a feature always kind of your goal from when you were going to college and after you graduated?
I can't really say it was a conscious goal. I can't say it was a conscious goal this quickly. Like I thought maybe it would happen further down the line, but, this movie was kind of a matter of happenstance in a way where I was actually hired to come on to a movie called Mail Order Monster, completely different script, completely different storyline. And I was gonna, you know, I was the line producer on it. And then a month before we were set to shoot, they lost funding, or maybe the funding wasn't even there. I don't really know. And I was like, ah, oh, this is such a good title. I contacted the writer and I bought the script. And I was like,
oh, wow.
Bought the script.
Holy moly.
I bought the script and I essentially rewrote it, you know, entirely. You know, the story was originally about a young boy whose parents separate and then get back together at the end. And there were elements I kept, but pretty much I gutted it because I was like, mail order monster. It spells out mom. Like, I want to play into that, you know, and mom's, or the subtitle of mom has always been a very interesting topic in my own life. Like, I have a stepmom and she's, you know, my closest friend. She's amazing. And I was like, there's really not a lot of, you know, I really want to take this family genre, which I never thought I would make, and really play into something that hasn't, a story that isn't given enough light. Like, take the elements of family movies that we absolutely love, but at the same time, like, so many step parents are treated in movies as like step monsters and all that stuff. And I was like, you know, let's make a more modern day family movie, but with that old school feel too. Feel that works, that old school kind of like format. So, you know, like I said, I essentially bought the script in October, I believe, and then started writing the script in November after I went to AFM for the first time.
Oh.
Because I went to AFM and I just started like pitching log lines. And what kind of stuck, I was like, okay, then that one stuck. I'm going to kind of riff off of that. So it ended up becoming this like semi-female empowerment step-parent positive family movie, sci-fi adventure thing. And then it just kind of like rolled from there.
So you kind of went after it because the circumstances just brought this idea to you, and had you not had this idea, it might have taken you a little longer to find it. Find the thing that made you passionate.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have made a genre film, or I probably wouldn't have made a family genre film. I probably would have done some, you know, like gritty thriller or sci-fi thing, like what, you know, most people do for their first feature. Like, no one's like, yes, I'm gonna make family movies as like, you know, a young college graduate. But I'm actually,
I don't know, maybe I did.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know why not. Like, some of the best movies are family movies. But you know, they tend to get a bad rap because people look at them as just like these, you know, B movie money makers, which couldn't be further from the truth, if you approach it correctly. And but yeah, it was really interesting too, because the reason I also gravitated towards the script and the title so much was because I did speak to, you know, some distributors at AFM, and I spoke to a couple distributor friends of mine before I bought the script, and they were like, you know, that's a really, really good title, and title's a big thing. And this is also towards like 2016, where people were really trying to grab onto more of those like family genre films because they were less risky. I mean, they still kind of are, but movies, I mean, the market's changing every year.
Right. Well, from what we heard is that those for like on demand, when, you know, families are scrolling through things to watch, you know, they're more apt to purchase something or rent something that they haven't heard of before if they have kids. Whereas, exactly. You know, as you get older, you're less likely to just take a risk on something. You want to know that there's an actor that you know or that you've heard about it written up somewhere or that's in wide release somehow.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you're 100% correct. And so, so I just, you know, based on those aspects, I was like, okay, well, for a first feature, like from a logistical and producing point of view, this is a lot less risky than trying to make some sort of, you know, festival drama. And I kind of had some theories on, you know, feature films from a producing point of view that I really wanted to test out. I like truly thought that most of the time independent filmmakers, when they, you know, I'd worked with a lot of different people on their indie features, and when they approach their first feature, they do a lot of things that cause them to lose a lot of money. So it's not just the nature of indie films. A lot of times people shoot themselves in the foot that make it so much harder on themselves. And I really wanted to approach this in a way where it's like, okay, I can use this as, you know, a little bit of a case study for like feature stuff. Be like, hey, I did this and it turned out, you know, to do fairly okay. And give me your money for the next one.
What are some of the things that you saw that people lose money on their first features? Like some of those mistakes?
It's a lot of the times it's not thinking about the final product from a packaging point of view. So they'll think about it from like the story and the creative, but they don't often think about like where it ends up, the life it's going to take, and then kind of reverse engineering from there. Like you guys were saying before we jumped on the podcast, like we decided not to do festivals because it's a family film and it really wouldn't help us. And also knowing that the family genre and the way independent film is changing so rapidly for us is it was about getting it out there as fast as possible. And I know a lot of indie film producers that I've worked with before, they tend to hold on to their movies too long in post. And sometimes they end up actually missing their market because their market was like 2 years ago, but they kept it in post. You know what I mean? Because a lot of fear or trying to recut it. And so that is a lot of ways they shoot themselves in the foot, or they think their movie is like the Sundance winner when it's not, because like, you know, every festival has a certain type of film that they're going to promote. Or, and sometimes too, like for, if you have a feature, you have to really like campaign for those festivals ahead of time, you know, and get the agency on board. Like, totally. It's not always the case. You know, a lot of the times you can just blindly submit, but you know, you got to make sure your film is right for that festival, even just from like the type, the tonally, you know, or the type of film that it is. Not, that's why there's different festivals for different types of films. So if people don't get into the Sundance or the Tribeca or the South By, they freak out, then they hold on to it, then they recut it. And then, you know, next thing you know, they've been holding on to this film for years and years and they've missed their market. And like, you know, films, the longer they stay in post, most of the time, there's always, you know, exceptions, they depreciate, you know what I mean? Like there's just going to be things that change that aren't as relevant as they used to be. Unless for some reason you have an actor in it that blew up in like 3 years while you were holding it. So there's that.
Right. Yeah. Unless you get lucky, basically.
Yeah. Unless you get lucky. And at the end of the day, it all like should be part of your strategy. A lot of times people also make a film without thinking about audience. It becomes very, for features especially, it becomes very just self-involved. You know, it's like, this is the story that I'm passionate about, that I want to tell, that is my life, and it's not really speaking to anyone. So yeah, they get to the market and it's like maybe beautifully shot and beautifully directed, but at the end of the day, like it's going to be hard for people to sell because they're like, really, no one cares about this as much as you. And so it's like, yeah, I guess no one does care about my grandfather as much as me, you know, because he wasn't famous.
I think it's a little easier for genre filmmakers, you know, whether it's like a comedy or a family film or sci-fi or horror. I think as long as you're satisfying the genre, you're going to be setting yourself up for more success than if you're just making an indie drama that, is about your grandfather who you love. But doesn't actually fit into any genre category. If it's about your grandfather that you love and then you turned it into, you know, like a genre movie around that grandfather, I think you'd probably have a lot better success, you know, because those genres sell, right?
Absolutely. Genre is really, really important when it comes to, but see, that's being smart and that's thinking about audience and that's like being able to you're correct. Like, you don't have to not tell a story about your grandfather, but be smart about it. Like, that's what separates, right, for me, short films for feature films. Short films, you really get to experiment. You know, no one's expecting to make their money back. You can make them for no money. Features technically too, but at the end of the day, like, it's a product that you're going to sell. So you have to think about, and you're creating a mini startup, a mini company every time you make a feature. So you have to think about things, especially if, you know, you're doing it very low budget indie and you're, you know, wearing all the hats. You don't have a full giant team behind you. So like, you really have to think about these things from their entire life and the whole scope of the package and not just the tiny portion, which is the story in the movie itself.
Yeah.
So speaking of shorts, how many shorts did you do before you went out and made this feature?
I made 3 shorts.
And how long were each of them?
All of them were under 15 minutes.
Did they play at festivals?
Yeah, they played at festivals and all were very different. Our very, very first short was like this little comedy. And that one, we really didn't push festivals too much because we were just, and we could have, we just didn't because we didn't really know what we were doing. And from there, I was getting some branded and commercial work. So I just kind of didn't really think about it. The other short, I did got into Holly Shorts, which was a lot of fun. And we did a couple other festivals out of that. And then I did another short film that's, you know, in 2016, that's, I mean, it's premiering at another festival in October, like next month as well. So it's, that one had a good festival run.
Yeah. Wow.
Nice. I'm really curious about, like, you wrote the movie and then how quickly you were able to get it made from when you finished the script. But first, when you went to the film market with your finished film earlier this year, did you experience any, like, you know, people being like, oh, well, what festivals did it win? Like, oh, where is the festival thing? Or was that just not a part of the conversation because you were at this film market selling this brand new movie that you just finished?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I mean, most distributors, like when you're selling to, you know, different countries or whatnot, really don't care about festivals unless it's a massive festival, or it's a really good, like, you know, credible genre festival for your film. Like for my family film, no one really cares about festivals. They're just like, oh, will we be able to sell it to our audience? At the end of the day, like, that's truthfully all they care about. But speaking on markets real quick, I actually took the teaser before the movie was done, the teaser to the American film market. And that's where we met with a bunch of different sales agents before we signed with our sales agent. So we did that actually before the movie was completed. So I always highly recommend people go to a film market before they've even done a movie, if they're thinking about doing a movie, if they just have a script, if they don't even have their film completed. Really, really recommend it. But when it went to EFM, it was kind of nice because, you know, I didn't have to be so hands-on with it. My sales agents took it. And we got 2 sales right out of that film market. And we got more sales out of Cannes when we screened there as well at that market. But honestly, we've never had any, like, issue as far as not doing festivals. There are a couple festivals that may be more helpful for family films as far as a marketing point of view. So with festivals, they sometimes don't always help with getting distribution. Sometimes another approach, which my sales agent and I talked about this too, is if you already have distribution and then going after festivals that line up with your release. So if you're going to be in a festival that's a little bit smaller, it's not like the big Sundances or whatever, you can go to maybe a second tier or third tier festival that come, you know, that happens to premiere or screen a month or two after your release, or maybe the same month or a month after. And then you can just use that PR to help drive the marketing for your film. Because a lot of the times what happens where people shoot themselves in the foot is they're like, cool, I screened at Bentonville Film Festival and I still don't have a distributor. Right. And at the end of the day, it's like all that PR and that audience that they built there, they kind of lose it by the time the film actually comes out.
Yeah, just going back to the AFM thing and the film markets, it's interesting because if the festival circuit is never really part of your distribution plan, then I guess it doesn't really ever hurt you in a way if you're just like, no, we're going straight to distribution and it's not like in your model, then no one's going to question it, right? No one's going to be like, oh, it didn't play at a film festival. You're like, yeah, because we didn't submit it. We're not doing it that way. You know?
Yeah, and that's very genre dependent too.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's probably easier to sell a movie, like a heavy dramatic piece, if it's won stuff at festivals, because that is what draws an audience to it, because it kind of puts that stamp of approval. But with a family 100%. Film, I mean, how many Pixar movies are kind of like, this movie was a winner at Sundance, or, you know, premiered at South by Southwest? That's not really the model for family films, and that's not what gets audiences to watch those films, and probably a lot of genre films too. So I think it just, yeah, depends on what the audience needs to feel like, oh, I'm gonna pay to go see that movie.
But like, honestly though, I mean, if I made, you know, say it like took the family out of it, and it was just like, you know, a really cool, fun sci-fi action film, and, you know, same release came out in November, I would have really positioned to premiere at like Fantastic Fest, right?
Because right, exactly. That audience needs that kind of stamp of approval.
Exactly.
But like, kids don't probably, because your main audience is going to be kids or families, and they're not looking for that marker on the movie before they buy it.
Yeah. To be honest, with this research that I've done on family films, and that we've luckily been able to acquire, is there are a lot of online review sites for parents that either parents have created or parental groups have created, and that is a resource that more families will go to see what films are kid approved, or like, because sometimes too, you watch a trailer, you watch a movie, and you're like, oh, this seems, you know, harmless enough, and then it turns out, you know, it's actually like, oh shit, I didn't really want my kids to see that. Yeah, one, you know, right. What I mean, so that's actually what we've targeted more so for our film, which we've been lucky to get really good reviews on, and they can help promote from that online perspective there.
Okay, I'm going back again off our outline, but I'm just really curious. So, like, when you went to AFM with the teaser for Mom, what were those meetings like? What were those conversations like? Did you just say, like, here's the teaser, the movie's in post, it'll be done X date? Or was it more like, here's the teaser, if you like it, we can send you a rough cut of the film? Like, what was your strategy like with the teaser?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I actually had a production consultant that I brought onto the film, like when it was still in its script stage. Her name's Stacey Parks of Film Specific. I don't know if you're familiar with her or whatnot. She does this really great client base, you know, just flat fee production consulting. And she essentially hooks you up with like all her contacts, right? So she set up a lot of meetings for me at AFM ahead of time, people she's worked with and vetted, because she comes from a distribution background. And I also set up meetings for myself. And I did exactly the first thing you said, which was, here's the teaser, this is the date it's going to be complete, let me know if you want to come to the screening. A lot of people wanted to see a rough cut, and I was very adamant about not sending them a rough cut, only because of the fact of our monster had to be completely created in post, as far as like the voice goes and the actual sound design. And like, without that, it was a very anticlimactic monster. And I was like, so much of my movie was sound design, and I really didn't feel comfortable sending that out, you know? So I think it just depends on your film. Like, if you know that the movie really comes across and all the elements are mostly there in a rough cut, you should probably send a rough cut out to only the sales agents or distributors that you're most serious about, because some of them may want to be involved in that final cut process. They may want to sign on and say, hey, if we just change this one little edit here, like, I know we can position us for like the Berlin Film Festival or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like, if you have one big element that is not there fully in your rough cut, that totally makes sense not to share that, because I think people are easily turned off, you know. And I think, despite being in show business, I think a lot of people in the business side of it don't necessarily always have the imagination to imagine what it would look like when it's done, you know. So I think, yeah, if like, for, you know, my movie, for example, if my portal's not done, I shouldn't be sending out the movie with an unfinished portal, because that'll completely kill the whole story, basically.
Absolutely. And everyone always has an opinion about it too, when it's not done. And you're just like, exactly. I don't want to hear your opinion, because you can't see my vision.
And I think they easily lose confidence as well, you know, because if they see something that they feel is unprofessional or just too low budget or something, then they immediately put you in a category that you're not necessarily in, you know? So I can see like that being a really smart move, to like wait until your monster is actually created, you know, before you start presenting it, because that's like the linchpin of your whole story in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I think also too, I was a little hypersensitive about it, because, you know, I did have producer friends of mine that had everyone involved in post. Like, they got opinions from everyone, and it actually ended up hurting the film more than helping it. And so I was actually quite adamant about no one actually seeing my film until it was done. I had people that watched, I had people that watched, the when I was in the edit, and I wanted some notes on that. And they were like very specific people that I, you know, chose to watch it that I knew would be very honest and whose opinions I trusted, and all had very differing opinions. But as far as once that was like locked, once picture was locked, I was like, yeah, no one's seeing it until it's done, because, you know, it needs to have, sometimes what happens also too, I find in indie films, when they have like too many opinions, or there's too many cooks in the kitchen, too many producers involved, the voice gets very muddled. The actual, like, that through line, that single voice from this for the story gets lost. And then sometimes the story becomes very convoluted. And I was like, at the end of the day, if I'm going to fail, I want to fail real hard and have it be my own fault. I don't want to have to, you know, say it was anyone else's fault, or be because I took too many opinions and I didn't trust myself enough. Like, I want to fall hard on my face if that's going to happen.
Back to, you know, before you made the movie, you wrote this script, you rewrote this script from scratch, basically. You know, you're done with it around in the fall of 2016, I guess. What do you do then? Like, how do you start the path to getting this movie actually made?
So I actually had made sure that I had the opportunity for funding available before I really started getting involved in writing this script when I did, because the script was being, you know, drafts were being done all the way up until when we were on set, like, or the day before set. I did 8 drafts of this film, like, very, very fast. So, I mean, I'm from Vegas. My family's in the food industry. There's a lot of people that I've met throughout my life that have always wanted to be involved in movies and have some income. So I was able to get private equity. But what was really attractive to investors, and also was really an interesting way for me to learn about getting people interested in investing in films, even if you don't really know them, was being able to package the tax structure of my film properly. So my whole goal was, no, even if this movie bombs, it makes zero money, investors actually still walk away happy, right? Which most people are like, that sounds completely unbelievable. And most people, like, especially if they're, you know, pretty wealthy business people or whatnot, they have a lot of tax losses and tax credits that they want to get rid of. You know, they need to spend money for taxes, tax purposes. But we shot in Kentucky because they have a 30 to 35% tax rebate, and it's refundable. It's not transferable, which means they gave a check to us, which was really, really nice. And we got that pretty quickly. But another thing I want to mention is, a lot of times when people bring on investors, they do Kickstarter, the actual LLC of the film never really includes the investors. So they become passive investors instead of active investors. And when you are an active investor and your name is part of a business, and you have a tax loss, say, like, you know, the first year you make a movie, you're not making any revenue because you're just spending money. So it's just expenses. And, you know, what they do is they fill out a K-1. You get their accountant fills out a K-1 for the investor. And they can essentially write off their entire investment because they are an active investor in a business. It's a business loss, not just an investment loss. So that in itself is a huge tax benefit to them on top of the tax incentive, that rebate that they get from the state. So that was something also I noticed not a lot of people do, because, you know, they want to shoot in LA or they want to shoot somewhere local to them because they can get things cheap, which actually may be a better, that may be more beneficial than going to a state that has tax benefits, which I can say, you know, there are definitely pros and very much cons to doing it. But something that I really encourage people to look at is getting less investors, so maybe getting 2 or 1 like strong investor in your film that then can take the majority of essentially the profit and loss on your film. So maybe you can work out a deal with them where you say, hey, I'm going to give you like 75 or 80% of the profit and loss on the film, which means they get the majority of the tax loss benefit. you know, or you can give them 100% of it and like you take a paycheck on the film. So it just depends how you structure it. But having your investors be active versus passive is much more beneficial to your investors.
Just a nerdy question. So if you have your LLC, the B members of the LLC are still active investors, right?
I believe so. I mean, we didn't have B members. It was kind of like there was just a few of us. It was just me and then the investors. So
yeah, because I'm doing this right now, and the way that I structured it was, or my lawyer structured it basically, was that, you know, I'm the only A member. I'm the only one who like actually owns, you know, like has control of the LLC basically. And then every investor is a B member. So like they're still part of the LLC and they're still connected to it and they still can do the, you know, K-1 forms and all that stuff. But, it's basically, they're not liable in the way that I am for the company.
Yeah,
you know?
Then that's good. As long as they can fill out that K-1, because that's getting them a federal tax benefit, not just the state tax benefit. And that's what's really important, because when you can explain that to investors, you're more likely going to get people, because then they can get that money back, that money back federally when they file their taxes that year within the first year of the movie. You know what I mean? And when they see that benefit, you know, they get to include any tax losses they may have had in their other businesses that year, you know, or personally. And, you know, if you include a state tax benefit, like those are all things, especially within the first year, to have your investors at least receiving money in that way. It really, really helps with the rest of the process, because they're going to be less, you're just going to feel less pressure, because you're going to get less phone calls of being like, where's my money? You know what I mean? And right, that's something that you just want to get, like, have that first year, just be like, hey, look, not only did we finish the movie, but also like, here's some money.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I do want to just state that all this, you know, sounds so wonderful, but it's a lot harder to get two or three investors to back your movie than it sounds.
Oh, no, 100%. Well, like, that's also why.
Like, people have told me that a bunch. They're like, oh, wouldn't you rather have like two or three investors rather than like 20 smaller investors? And I'm like, yeah, of course I would. Well, do you know these people?
Well, 100%. Like, you are 100% correct. But, and something I will say on that too is like, the way I did my movie this time actually isn't as viable today, because, you know, after working with my sales agents and like having a lot of different meetings and conversations, so many sales agents want to be involved in script stage now. Like, they want to be executive producers now, because they want to be able to control how you get your funding. They want to be able to control, you know, if they can get pre-sales because of their relationships and because of how they're packaging the movie. So that's something, because a lot of sales agents now too are becoming distributors, just like, you know, Film Mode Entertainment for me, and a lot of different distribution companies around the world are merging as the whole market changes. So something I would actually suggest, beyond just trying to find your own investors, is I would highly suggest maybe having a couple investors that are like interested but not committed yet, and then go to a film market with your script, with a bit of a package that you've created, how you see it, and have some meetings, or get with like a Stacey Parks. She's also great, and she also can help find funding for your film, depending if you want her to be an executive producer or not. So there are a lot of ways outside of just the typical structure of like Kickstarter and then finding people that have money. There's actually people that are professionals at finding money that really want to help you find money, and they want to be involved in your film too. Sorry, my dogs are sneezing, if you hear sneezing.
That's okay.
Very sneezy dogs. And they shake as well. So that's something also to consider, is like, look at your distribution and sales first and think, okay, is my film along the genres or along the lines of films that they really distribute and do well at? And are they the type of sales agents or distribution companies that want to become executive producers on films now? And that is like becoming more and more common.
Yeah, I did the whole AFM thing last year in 2017, and you know, I had a good experience. I had like a whole bunch of meetings. I pitched the movie. I got a lot of great feedback, but the thing that everybody told me was, who's going to star in it? And then how much of the budget have you raised? You know, and I had raised probably like, I don't know, it was like $15,000, $20,000 at that point.
Oh,
and
wow.
That just didn't move the needle for anybody, basically. That was just not enough, you know?
Yeah.
And then basically they're just like, oh, yeah, come back next year with, what did they say? They said, come back next year with your full budget or, you know, or a teaser trailer or something, or just go make it on your own with a no budget.
Oh, so
like kind of all the advice I got.
So many people. I mean, listen, I had that said to me so many times. When I was writing my script, someone told me I should quit writing. Like, there were so many things
that
have been said that, like, crack me up all the time. But that's why, honestly, especially when it's your first film, everyone's very hesitant. Like, that's the thing is like, oh, cool. So I need to just like make a movie and just somehow do that. And then you'll all back me on my second one. So they say, right?
Yeah, that was also what they were saying too. Yeah, like, you know, make a feature and then come back with this project.
Exactly. Because you know, again, yeah. At the end of the day, like, it's all about risk reward. It's all about trust. So sure, like, if I was in their position, I'd probably be saying the same thing because, like, you know, I don't want to lose money because I'm taking a risk on someone that has no track record, right? So I didn't hold it against them. I understand that. But that's why working with someone like Stacy, she's a very small investment from your film. Tiny investment to have her as a production consultant. Like, she was great. She helped vet my cast of like who would be marketable and who wouldn't be based on the budget that we had. She was there like throughout every step of the way, and she's a pro. And which is great because it's like I said, she can come on as an executive producer in your film and help you like fully get funding, absolutely everything, the whole shebang. Or she can come on as a consultant where she has like no stake in your movie. You just pay her a small flat fee and she's involved from beginning to end. And like, that's wow. Something that I knew. I was like, okay, this is my first time. I don't know everything at all. So I need to at least bring one or two people on board that have done this a million times and no distribution and can help guide me through the process. So I'm not spending money I don't need to spend and not, you know, and just kind of avoiding a lot of those pitfalls.
Yeah. So just to be clear, you had secured your funding before you even bought the script in order to rewrite it? Or like what point did you know that you had the funding you needed to make the movie? Was it after the first draft or?
It was pretty much, I knew that the possibility was there before I bought it. And then by the time I wrote the first draft, I knew that I could get the funding.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great position to be in, you know. I'm sure that made things a lot easier moving forward and getting everything done.
It absolutely did. I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, it costs nothing to write a script. You know what I mean? It costs time. So my thing was kind of like, you know, I'm in a very fortunate position where it's like, I know I can get this money and I don't, you know, I'm going to make this script as good as it can be so I don't have to, because again, talking about pitfalls that people make, reshoots and pickups had taken up a lot of people's time, you know, in staying in post for many, many years. So I was like, it's a lot cheaper for me to do rewrites in a script than having to get more funding for pickups and reshoots. And that was the thing too.
Right.
I was like, I was adamant about never, ever, ever going back to my investors for more money at all. Because I'd seen that happen too many times. So that never happened, which was awesome. We actually ended up being on schedule and under budget by the time we wrapped.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Nice. So how did you know that you would have funding available to you after you finished your script? Did you talk to people ahead of time, or you just
yeah.
kind of a calculation based off of who you knew?
Yeah, I've spoken to people ahead of time too. And like a lot of the times, especially like coming from Vegas, you know, it's a small town. Everyone knows each other. It's like, oh, you're in LA making movies and doing things like that. And then, you know, everyone always wants to talk to you about the movies when you just, even if you're doing nothing, just the fact that you're in LA and you're even interested in movies, everyone thinks that you're like buddy buddy with George Clooney or something like that. It's like, yo, dude, that's not like, that's furthest from the truth. That's like, that's not how it happens. It's like,
I might have seen him once while walking in Santa Monica, but that's as close as I got.
I know people forget like how small town Vegas is sometimes. But so just different conversations, just, you know, throughout being in LA and then coming back to Vegas, or, you know, conversations with family, friends and family, you know, people just kind of like, they just, you know, express interest in maybe wanting to do something. And so I was able to have those conversations ahead of time. There was serious interest from people about wanting to get involved in the movies in that way, especially too, as a lot of people I knew were older as well.
Yeah.
They weren't just like, you know, they'd started their startup last year and were just as broke as I am.
Cool. Well, Ulrich, should we jump over to directing children?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear about this too. I mean, I worked with a 16-year-old on my movie. My whole take on kids is that they're the best actors to work with if you can find one that's just naturally gifted, just because they're so raw and open and emotional that it doesn't take a lot to get a performance out of them. I think it's more important to choose the right person in casting than it is about like techniques on set. What was your experience working with the 12-year-old?
I 100% agree with you. I mean, they're so raw and amazing. Madison is just like not human. She's so talented, but also too, she's just the best. She's like a little robot. She shows up on set like perfectly on time, ready to go. I give her, you know, just one or two notes every now and then. She always hit it perfectly. She was just such a gem to work with. And granted, her family's the best. And, you know, we auditioned a lot of kids from all over the country, actually. And any kid that was involved in callbacks, I had them do the callback. And then they stepped out and I brought their parents in and I interviewed their parents because I knew, one, this is my first time working with kids. Two, I'm going to be in a remote location, which is Southern Kentucky. I do not want to be dealing with, you know, crazy parents, especially on a very low budget feature. And a lot of these kids have worked on TV and, you know, the parents can be very, very demanding. And I'm like, I just can't. I need someone that's going to be willing to work with me in a lot of ways. And Madison just has the best family. Her two older sisters also act. Her eldest, Madeline, is in like a new YouTube, the star of like a new YouTube series coming out. She's worked a lot. But Madison was just, she just is a really, she's very quiet and like a really good listener. And so I just knew from the get, she was one of the first people I ever auditioned. And I knew right then and there that she was going to be it, even though I continued auditioning people after her. I worked with Emma as well. And Emma was, I think, 13 when we were on set. So they were only a year difference. But like, what's super interesting about that age between 10 and 14 is no one looks the same. Like there is no set, like when people get into high school, like they sometimes have a similar look because they've hit puberty and da, 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 da. When they're, you know, under 10, elementary school, they all kind of look similar. That middle school age, everyone develops at different times. Some are going through growth spurts, some are not going through. So everyone looks different.
Yeah, some of them look like they're 9 years old and some of them look like they're in college.
Exactly. And but they're all the same age. And so that was super, super interesting, but very real, you know. So Emma had just gone through this huge growth spurt and Madison's super, super tiny. So we really played up on that in the script as well, as far as like the bullying goes. And Emma was also a gem to work with. I mean, she's worked, you know, since she was younger as well. So both were pros. Like they knew set etiquette. They knew like just the urgency of schedule and like how important it was for them to hit their mark and how important it was. So I really didn't have to tell them that much. Like the actors really nailed it. Like sometimes I had more issues with the adults than the kids, which was funny. But the craziest part of working with kids was all the extras that we had were all local Kentucky kids. And at one day, I think we had roughly like 130 kids in a scene. And I was like, oh, wow. And like no time. And you know, none of them had really ever acted before. But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, kids, that sounds overwhelming. One kid, few kids, yeah, you can kind of like talk to them and get into their imagination. But as soon as there's like a group of kids, they start judging each other. And then, you know, they can start breaking down and or doing things just to kind of get a laugh out of their group mates.
Oh, yes, 100%. So you really just like, I mean, honestly, so much of it is a blur because we were moving so quickly that I just kind of went into game mode and then just went, you know, boom, boom, boom. Like this is what needs to happen. And most people really just were on board with that. I didn't have to push people too much because they kind of were like, oh, this person's moving and either we're going to get moving with her or she's probably going to kick us out.
Yeah. So did you find your kids in LA and then bring them with you to Kentucky?
Only Madison. She's the only one. Everyone else was local.
And did you shoot this as a SAG production?
Yes, we did. It was a SAG modified low budget film.
So does that mean you had like set hours with the kids and you had to have, what, a tutor on set? Like, how does that work? What are the restrictions?
So actually in Kentucky during the summer, you don't have to have a tutor if they're a Kentucky local. And with Madison, she was able to become a Kentucky local. Like, her parents had a home that was like in the area and things like that, because they were originally from Alabama. So, and like, you know, you're just able to get her an address and things like that. So she was able to be a Kentucky local. So we didn't need to have an on-set tutor with her, which was huge for us because, you know, like, every penny counts. And for us, it was like, ugh, you know, because if someone's a California local and you shoot in another state and they need to have a tutor, you can't get a local tutor. It has to be a California tutor. Oh, so I would have really? Had to fly out and house a California tutor.
You have
travel, tutor,
you have their day rate, you have an extra mouth to feed.
And I'm like, no, that's just not feasible right now. You know what I mean? So we were able to, you know, work with her family and her, you know, prior address that she had and whatnot, and able to make sure that was okay. But luckily, Emma, even though she's worked all over and worked a lot in New York, she's from Lexington, I believe, Lexington, Kentucky. So she was fine. And then all the rest of the kids were local to that area. And the town was very small. It was like Munfordville, which we mostly shot there, only has like 1,600 people as far as our population goes.
Did you luck out that you were able to find so many people that could work local, or was that a conscious decision going into casting?
That was a conscious decision. Southern Kentucky, just Kentucky in general, because they have their tax incentive, they're really pushing a lot for film. And a lot of people, it's where we were, was very close to Nashville as well. So that you get a lot of people that can work local Kentucky, that really just want to be in films. And it's a lot of locals from the area, just, you know, they want to be in a movie during the summer because kids are off and it's like, that sounds fun. And they've never done anything like that before. So we were able to hold a casting in the area and, you know, we cast from there.
So what about time restrictions and shooting? Do you get only 8 hours a day with anyone who's a minor?
That was the hardest part. 100%.
And then do they have like certain breaks throughout the day that they have to take, or you just can work them for any time during that 8 hours?
No, I mean, the 8 hours is pretty much what you're given, including like once you take out the breaks as well, because it's like they have to have an hour lunch, right? And it's like as soon as they step on set, and luckily Madison was super quick about, you know, getting in wardrobe and hair and makeup and everything like that. I don't remember exactly what it was. My AD would have to tell me. I think it was 9 hours from when they step on set, including lunch, and when they're wrapped. So by the time you take out that time, it's actually some days it was even less than 8 hours, because lunch is an hour and then hair and makeup and, you know, the whole thing. And the thing that was challenging is Madison's in, you know, 90% of the film. I think the whole script is like 154 scenes. I think she's in like 145 of them. So it was a challenge.
Yeah, I bet. And were you guys shooting after she left set on most days, or were you guys just kind of following her schedule?
See, and ideally that's what it would have been, but, you know, we did the whole thing in 17 days, which, let me tell you, don't ever do that.
If you had to do it again, how many days would you take?
20. I mean, because of our budget, we couldn't. We like had to keep it.
That's kind of the case with all of us, is like we can only shoot as many days as we can raise money for.
And exactly.
So most of us are doing feature films for in like the 10 to 15 day range.
Which, if I had adults only, like, totally, let's, you know, ball it out and we're going to, you know, just make this movie and then you can sleep later. With a kid, it's entirely different. And, you know, granted, again, like, I don't regret it at all. What was also interesting too is within that time frame, there were times like I had an assistant editor who was my data manager, and he would cut some scenes for me, and I would straight up do reshoots and pickups on top of my schedule while we were there, because I knew we could never come back. So we would have our schedule, which was, you know, sometimes 13 scenes in a day, and I would add reshoots of certain things or pickups because I'm like, they didn't get it, I need to get it again. Because you have to, like, when you know you didn't get it and you know it's a pivotal part of the film, you're like, you know, most things I was pretty flexible with. But when I knew that I had to get something again, I was like, man, we can't come back here. Like, we have to add it on top of the schedule. So the thing with Madison was she would work in both the day and the night scenes, both interior, exterior as well. So very rarely was I able to shoot past her. The times that we did, it would be when it was like coverage. If she was, you know, if it was a two-person scene between her and the monster, we'd shoot Madison out. And if we had to get, you know, the monster after her, we would do, you know, him last, or with Josh and Charisma, we would, you know, shoot Madison out first and then, and do them after if we were running low on time.
This is a little bit of a tangent with SAG. Who is responsible for paying SAG residuals on your production? Is it the distributor or you?
I believe it's me is how that works. When, cause I read up all up on it with SAG, is that I believe unless you're going through, now they have companies that do it. I forgot what they're called, but essentially they have companies that take in all of the, like, you know, they'll take a percentage or whatever. And, you know, they'll be the ones that it's an account that take in all the money. And then based on the contracts or whatever, they pay everyone out. You know, based on like what type of SAG production you are, you know, what, how many points this producer was promised and da 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 da. But I'm pretty sure because we didn't do that account, because for our size movie and everything like that, it just didn't really make financial sense. Yeah, it's producers.
Yeah. Are you prepared for when that bill comes? Do you know what it's going to be and when it's going to come?
I have no idea. And it's also different too, because it's based on, now this is a thing too that's interesting. I think if it's based on, like, I think if a TV network buys the movie or does something like that, I think they pay the residuals. I'd have to check on that. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. I only have heard one experience with SAG and residuals, and the producer was responsible for paying them even though they had a distribution company. And so I guess they got a check from the distribution company, and that check was almost equal to what they had to pay SAG. So they just like kind of turned that money right back around and paid SAG.
It's really depressing when you start to look at SAG residuals, especially too, because they changed the contract on day one of my shooting day with when the pension and health went up from like 17.3 to 18%. And the whole thing happened on day one of my film, but they didn't come up with the number that it would be increased to until my last day, but we had to pay retroactively.
Man.
Wow. Well, yeah, I think it depends on the deal that you get, right? Like, I think some deals, the production company or the distributor is, well, not the production company, the distributor is responsible. And then some deals, the production company or the LLC of the original film is responsible. So I just think it depends on the deal you get. And I think the worse deal you get, you know, the more likely it is that you're responsible for the residuals, which happened to a couple friends of mine, you know, in their projects.
Yeah, I think most indie films, like especially when you're going to be doing like the VOD side and like you're splitting up your sales and it's not just like one giant buyout from like a massive, you know, studio or company. Yeah, it's like you're probably going to be the one that's responsible for those good old SAG residuals.
Yeah, it seems like there should be a way to kind of calculate what your residuals might be ahead of time. I work in advertising and we have a business affairs department. And when we want to figure out the residuals on a commercial, you know, we can have them run the numbers based off of where we think it's going to play. So there's got to be some way to kind of figure it out. And so that way, as filmmakers, we're armed, at least when we're negotiating a distribution deal, to say, hey, every time if you guys sell it to this kind of market, that's going to mean this is that cost to me. So I need you guys to kind of guarantee at least this minimum, so I'm not out of pocket on these residuals.
Oh, totally. That would be a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they could have like an actual calculator for it, especially if you could just put in, you know, an estimated calculator. I know they're doing that more and more for tax incentives too, where it's like you can input your budget and like where certain things are going, and they can give you like an estimated number for what you're going to get back from that state. And so that would be really great to do that.
Be researched. We will figure this out. Ulrich, you have any questions about directing a minor?
I do. I'm curious, how much time did you get to rehearse with Madison? What did you have, like a two or three whole days where you were able to just go through the whole movie with her and like, you know, kind of read lines and talk about the character and blocking, or was it more like you just got to rehearse with her like one or two times before you actually shot each take, each scene?
Yeah, pretty much that. And I had spoken to Madison, you know, pretty extensively about it during the audition process and callback process. And then I took her family and herself like out to dinner before we all went to Kentucky and we talked then. But when we were on set, it was game time. Like there was no, I didn't get to, you know, rehearse with her for 3 days or anything like that. It was just, okay, let's rehearse the scene. Cool. Let's shoot it. Go. That's how it was. And very quickly, you know, that's a lot of the reason why I cast Madison is because of how quickly she took notes. I knew, and then how also the understanding of the character that she had ahead of time. So I knew that I didn't have to spend a lot of time with her in rehearsals. Because at the end of the day, it's like when you're producing and directing and you're the writer, you don't have that time, especially when like you're working with SAG and you have to pay for rehearsals and all these other things as well. So I You're good. But point being that like, yeah, I don't even think I rehearsed other than just like rehearsing a scene, you know, with camera and everything before you actually go for a take. Like we didn't do any like structured rehearsals.
Wow. So you didn't have any rehearsal days with any of the cast. You just jumped right in after having conversations with them, basically.
Yeah. We would grab like with Josh and Charisma. We spoke and like had lunch individually ahead of time. But like, yeah, that was it. I mean, a lot of these actors too, especially when they come from TV, they're used to that, you know, they're used to just showing up, you know, having a conversation during a table read or whatever, the script, and showing up on set with an understanding of the character and going for it. But a lot of them are very much used to not having these extensive rehearsals ahead of time. So they were all pros. I mean, and again, like that's where casting is so important, because you're not just casting, you know, the right character, you're also casting the right actor that's going to be best for your set and your parameters.
In my mind, I have this really glorified idea of being able to rehearse with my actors like for like, you know, a full day or two days or whatever it is, you know. But I think the reality is probably going to be just like what you're saying, you know, you just get to set and you gotta rock and roll, because you know, you can't afford rehearsal days, and you know no one's gonna have time basically.
Yeah, and I think it also depends on your film too. Like if you're doing, if there's like a very fight choreographed, like stunt heavy scene or whatever, then yeah, you may want to have that rehearsal done ahead of time. Or if you're the way that your film or the style of your film is structured is, you know, a lot of long takes with a lot of different characters where you do need to have a lot of that blocking choreographed and just thought out ahead of time, like that actually may end up saving you money because you won't be doing take after take after take to get it right. But for my film, it just wasn't necessary.
I think the one thing I want to ask Paulina is like, you know, what was something that you learned in working with minors that you'd pass on to other directors who maybe have never worked with a minor before, who are just starting to work with minors? Like, what's one thing that you learned through your experience that, you know, you would definitely do next time?
Absolutely. Audition the parents, because you're going to get a good sense of the kid through the parents and how the parents act. So that's a really big thing. And let them do their thing. But when it comes to notes, be very, very specific, because kids are sponges, but they're also really, you know, the way at this point in their lives, like when they're at school, okay, here's an assignment. This is how you do it. This is the result. Same with parents. Like, these are your chores. This is what we expect. So they're used to things being a little bit more, this is what I need, right? This is a specific objective. Whereas with adults, it can be a little bit more of a conversation and a collaboration in that respect. So that's how you may want to direct them a little bit differently. But with kids too, and I think honestly it goes with all actors, like it's really, really important to just have fun, because the minute you stop having fun, they stop having fun. And if they're not having fun anymore, now you've lost them. So it's really important, like, to remember, like, we're just making a movie. No matter what happens, like, it's not the end of the world. And keeping that lightness is going to help, you know, just like Timothy, you were saying, like kids are so imaginative and they're so raw, and creating that space for them to bring that out is really important. And if your space is very tense, like kids are so energetically intuitive, you know, and they're going to, but they're not always the most like articulate when it comes to their emotions. So they're not going to be able to say like some older actors, like, I don't like the energy in this room, I can't act in it. You know what I mean? They're just going to start maybe like not giving their best performance or shutting down a little bit. So just be very aware of that, and really speak to their parents a lot on set, keep their parents happy. And, you know, that will help them keep their kid happy too, because when you're directing a different scene, they're off with their parents. And if their parents were like, wow, that was amazing, you're doing so great, like, I love this set, the director is so fun, that's going to play into the kid's experience as well.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. I just started working with kids recently, and a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old on a sitcom that I've been directing. I've done 3 episodes so far, and I think I might do one more coming up soon. But anyways, that's sort of been my experience too, is just to be clear. And, you know, we have to shoot a lot in a really short amount of time, and I got no rehearsal time with them on both the shoots I did. So I just found being clear and, you know, just, and then talking to the parents to make sure that everything's okay. That's sort of, you know, what worked for me so far.
That's true. But I actually think it makes you a better director overall because you have to be so clear.
Yeah. It's weird. I'm kind of funny with kids. I don't really like talk to them as kids. I kind of just talk to them as mini adults. You
Same.
Know? Oh, for you too? Okay.
Yeah. That's how they want to be spoken to.
Yeah, that's funny, because I've seen other directors, like, you know, kind of get their, like, their kids sort of approach, you know, especially with younger actors, you know, even, like, under 9, you know, and I'm like always, like, impressed on, like, how charming and, you know, affable these directors can be with kids. But for me, I can't do that. I just have to treat them like any other member of the crew or any other actor, you know, just be like, yes, you are a little person, I'm going to treat you like
an adult. That's good, though. It sets the standard of professionalism.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's worked out so far. So, you know, I'm going to stick with it. But I'd love to hear from other people, like, you know, what their approaches are. But I think it's fun. It's nice to hear that someone else does it the same way that I do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Timothy, any last final questions before we wrap things up?
No, I feel good. Paulina, where can people find you?
People can find me on all the socials. I'm on Instagram at Paulina Lagudi, and then at Mail Order Monster is our Instagram. Mail Order Monster Movie on Facebook. And I'm also Paulina Lagudi on Facebook. You can go to our website, which is mailordermonstermovie.com. We have a lot posted there. And then I have Jax Productions is my company. So you can go jaxproductions.com or jaxmakesmovies.com. Pretty much if you just Google my name, I think I'm like the only one out there. So
the only Paulina Lagudi out there.
Yeah.
All right. It's time for this week's The Game question. What's the game, you ask? Why? The game is Handmade Homespun from our producer, Eric Toms. It is a hypothetical indie film question, quandary, quagmire, problem that he puts forth, and then we listen to it for the first time while we're recording, and we give our initial impulsive suggestion on how we would solve this problem. All right, so this question is for Ulrich. Hey, Ulrich, you're shooting a contained, low-budget, Monster of the Week sci-fi horror film. Oh, wow, man. That just sounds horrible. We should just skip
sounds
this question.
So great.
I know. You would love it. You would love it.
I'm okay. In.
However, you and the rest of the cast/crew have decided to really elevate the movie into something special. You've cast the best no-name actors you could find, as well as terrific up-and-coming crew members. You're most excited about your miniature model team and the alien ship they've been constructing. Unfortunately, when you see the final product, you are horrified with how bad it looks. The model cost you quite a bit of money and you had hopes for it, but you're afraid that if you show footage in the movie of all the work the cast and crew have put forth, you will be ruined and they'll be ruined too. Everyone's going to be ruined. Do wow. you A, scrap the model and just move on, trying to focus on what you have in place? B, use the model, but only in very low light and in bits and pieces? See if you can blow up the model or use it in a new way that will still get you bang for your buck. D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Okay, so it's a model of a spaceship, like interior, exterior model. Is that what it is?
Just says final product, miniature model team, alien ship, just alien ship.
Okay. All right. Well, here's what I got. Yeah. So I'm assuming that there's interior portions and exterior portions to this alien ship, just for fun. And the way that I would do this is we have the model that we have, light it as best as we can to accentuate the positives and hide the negatives, and then shoot it the way that we plan to shoot it. And if there wasn't an explosion imminent for this alien ship, write that into the movie for sure, because best explode it, because that's like, I feel like every time I watch a movie where there's a miniature exploding, it just makes my heart jump in the best way possible. I'm so happy when I get to see a miniature explode. It's just like when someone goes insane, like in, I don't know if you've seen the original Roadhouse, I'm sure you have.
Yes.
They have multiple explosions where like, it's not like it's somewhat plausible. Like, yeah, buildings can explode this way. It's like someone jammed like two cases of like dynamite or C4 into this thing, and it just blows up like it's all explosion. And it's so glorious and so ridiculously unrealistic. Like, things don't blow up that way. I just love it. So my point is, yes, I would definitely explode it if we hadn't already planned to. But once we shoot the footage of the miniature, then I bring in my VFX team. Yeah. And they look at it and they see what they can do to spruce it up and make it better. And in the very least, if they can't make it better, then we'll do, I don't know if you've heard about this, but you can take there's an app. You can take a 3D image of a space and you can make a 3D model of it. Mm-hmm. So before we blow it up, I would make 3D models of the miniature. And then I would get that to my VFX team and they'd have a 3D model of the thing. So like, basically, you could either easily augment it to make it look better by bringing it into a 3D program, or if it just looks garbage and there's no way you can make it look better, then we just spend a little extra money, raise it, go do a crowdfunding or something to do the 3D version of it using the models that we made from the actual miniature design. And I think that way, it's like you have a chance of saving the miniature work and actually getting to use some of it in the movie. And then if not, you have a great backup plan you can execute instead of that. And then all in all, in the end, you have a great explosion that you can use in the movie, either as a you know, a end of the movie sort of post-credits sequence, or you can write it into the main story if it didn't already exist. But yeah, no, I mean, just a little bit of background. Like, you know, I love my practical teams like that I've worked with, but they always like, they need a little love. Like, you know, like, yeah. Not always. There's definitely some shots in my movie where like they're untouched, but like for most of the time, especially if you're trying to do something that's photo real, like you need a little bit of VFX work to like send it over that uncanny valley into like, this looks like a real person, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I always augment practical with digital, you know, with visual effects. So this just sort of seems in line with what I already do. But yeah, I don't know. Eric, can you make this happen? Can this be my life? Can I make this movie? Oh. Can you set that up? This sounds like my dream. Oh my God. I would die.
This question was made for you. 10 out of 10, no notes, nothing to add. I don't like, what am I going to say? But Eric did have something for me to read after you answered.
Oh, okay.
So he said, this is based off of the 1979 production of Alien. When director Ridley Scott arrived on set and saw the fully constructed alien ship referred to as the Derelict, he thought it looked like absolute garbage. He knew he couldn't shoot it traditionally. And since this was the dawn of home video, he asked if any of the crew members owned a camcorder. Luckily, one did. So they ran home and filmed the ship model using the low quality shaky camera as if it were one of the crew members' body cams. And the audience couldn't tell that the model was poorly built. Wow. So it sounds like it was interior, but I didn't read it until after.
Yeah, no, I know the exact shot they're talking about. But then, yeah, because the sets in that movie look amazing. Like when they're walking through the derelict ship, it looks crazy.
Yeah,
that's interesting that the model work didn't match the set, the big sets they built. That's kind of funny.
Well, does anyone listening have a different opinion? Send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freimut, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for doing our social media. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.